That's right. And now we get to see how well you follow instructions. Strip down. Excuse me? Get naked? I don't think so. It works like this. They're going to examine every square inch of your clothes while I examine every square inch of your body. I understand you were chipped when you met with Kate last night. That means we better find a nice, fresh, ugly-as-sin, stitched-up cut on the back of your leg. If we don't, if I arrive at the conclusion you're trying to pull one past us, guess what? Brad, I did exactly guess what? What? We're going to hack you to death with machetes right here. And I know what you're thinking. That would start a war, Brad. That's what you're thinking, right? Well, guess what? We don't give a fuck. We're ready. Ethan unbuckled his belt, shoved his jeans and briefs down his legs, and said, "Knock yourselves out." Ethan pulled off his hoodie and handed it to one of the men with a machete. As he came out of his undershirt, Brad knelt down behind him and ran a gloved finger over the incision. "It's fresh," he said. "You do this yourself?" "Yeah." "When?" "This morning." "Best keep it clean while it heals. Get your boots off." "Aren't you going to buy me dinner first?" Tough crowd. Not even a snigger. Soon, Ethan was standing naked. The kerosene lantern didn't shed much light as the three men crouched around the glow, inspecting Ethan's clothes and turning them inside out, every sleeve, every pocket. The walls of the ancient culvert were 6 feet apart and 6 feet high. Everywhere he looked, the concrete was crumbling to the point that it barely resembled concrete. This could have been the catacombs beneath some European city, although in all likelihood it was simply one of the latest remaining pieces of infrastructure from the original 21st-century Wayward Pines. The tunnel ran on a slight incline toward what Ethan figured was the east side of town. It made sense. That big wall of mountains probably drained copious amounts of water during thunderstorms. Massive snow melt when summer roared in. Even now, a trickle of water meandered through the disintegrating concrete under Ethan's feet. Brad looked up, tossed his undershirt to him, said, "You can get dressed." As they walked up the tunnel, their footsteps splashing in the runoff, a palpable disappointment hung in the cold, dank air. These farm boys had wanted to kill him, had been aching to dismember him. He just hadn't given them cause. The ceiling was low enough to force Ethan to walk hunched over. The tunnel lay in ruin. Vines trailed down the walls. Gnarled rebar showed through the concrete. Roots. Lines of snowmelt branched down the walls and dripped from the ceiling. The lantern only showed what lay 20 feet ahead, and the sound of tiny, scurrying footsteps seemed to be perpetually just beyond the light's reach. They passed through intersections with other tunnels, by more ladders that ascended into darkness. Ethan's boots crushed all manner of things, rocks, dirt, debris carried down from the mountains in heavy rainstorms, a rat's skull. He didn't know how long they trudged through that firelit darkness. It seemed to take both ages and no time at all. The quality of the air changed. It had been stagnant and marginally warmer than conditions in town. Now they were walking into a steady breeze that brought the fresh chill of the world above. The trickle running down the floor of the tunnel had expanded into a fast-moving stream, and instead of just the noise of their footfalls in the water, a new, more substantial sound had begun to build. They walked out of the tunnel into a rocky streambed. Ethan followed the men as they scrambled up the bank. When they reached level ground and stopped for a breather, he finally identified the noise that was now so overbearing he would have had to shout to be heard. He couldn't see in the oppressive starless dark, but in the near distance, a waterfall was crashing into the ground. He could hear the main cascade pummeling rock with a constant, thudding splat, and his face was damp with mist. The men were already moving on, and he followed the glow of the lamp, like a lifeline, as they climbed into a dense pine wood. There was no path that he could see. The white noise of the falls slowly faded away until he heard nothing but the sound of his own respirations in the increasingly thin air. He had been cold in the tunnel. Now he sweated. And still they climbed, trees clustered so closely that only the faintest dusting of snow had found its way to the forest floor. Ethan kept looking back down the hillside, straining to see the lights of Wayward Pines, but it was all as black as pitch. Suddenly there was no place else for the woods to go. The trees simply ended at a wall of rock. The men didn't stop, didn't even pause, just walked on right up the face of it. Imming shouting back, "It's steep, but there's a path. Just step exactly where we do, and be glad it's dark." "Why?" Ethan asked. The men just laughed. The forest had been steep. This was insane. Imming hooked the lantern onto a leather strap and slung it over his shoulder so he could use all four appendages. "Because you needed them." The mountain swept up well beyond the shit-yourself side of 50 degrees. A steel cable had been bolted into the rock, and there was some semblance of a path running alongside it, small footholds and indentations in the rock that appeared to suggest a trail. Most were natural, some looked man-made. It all looked suicidal. Ethan clung to the rusted cable. It was life. They ascended. Nothing to see but the meager patch of lantern-lit rock in their immediate vicinity. At the first switchback, the pitch steepened. Ethan had no concept of how high they had climbed, but he had a terrifying sense that they were already above the forest. The wind kicked up. Without the protection of the trees below, the rock had collected a quarter inch of snow. Now it was steep and slippery. Even Imming and his men slowed their maniac pace, everyone taking careful steps, making sure each foothold was sound. Ethan's hands grew stiff with cold. At this height, the cable had been lacquered with snow, and each new step required Ethan to brush it off before proceeding. Past the sixth switchback, the cliff abandoned all reason and went vertical. Ethan was shivering now. His legs had turned to jelly. He couldn't be sure, but it felt like the strain of climbing had ripped the stitches at his incision site, a trail of blood running down the back of his leg and into his boot. He stopped to catch his breath and refortify his nerve. When he looked up again, the lantern had vanished. There was nothing above him, nothing below, just endless swimming darkness.
"Sheriff!"
Imming's voice. Ethan looked up and down again, still nothing.
"Burke! Over here!"
He glanced across the cliff. There was the light, 20 feet away, but they weren't climbing anymore. They had somehow moved across the sheer face of the cliff.
"You coming or what?"
Ethan glanced down and saw it. One long step away, a single plank, 6 inches wide, had been bolted into the rock with a smaller cable running parallel above it.
"Let's go!" Imming yelled.
Ethan stepped from the foothold across 2 feet of emptiness onto the 6-inch plank. It was coated with slush, and the back half of his cowboy boots hung off the edge. He clutched the cable, went to move his right boot, but its smooth sole lost traction on the icy board. His feet went out from under him. The scream he heard was his own. His chest slammed against the rock, one hand barely gripping the cable as his weight tugged him down, the twined metal biting into his fingers. Imming was shouting at him, but Ethan didn't comprehend the words. He was zoned in on the cold, cutting steel, as he felt his grip slowly dissolving and his boots beginning to slide off his feet. He saw himself slipping, imagined the stunning lift of his stomach, his arms and legs flailing. Could there be anything worse than falling in total darkness? At least in the daylight, you'd see the ground rushing up to end you, have a chance, albeit fleeting, to prepare. He pulled himself up by the cable until his boots touched the plank again, leaned into the rock, gasping, hand bleeding, legs shaking.
"You asshole! Try not to die, okay?"
The men laughed and their footsteps trailed away. No time to regroup. With meticulous sidesteps, he traversed the rock face. After 5 minutes of terror, the lantern disappeared around a corner. Ethan followed, and to his infinite relief, the trail widened. No more cable or wooden planks. Now they walked up a gentle sloping ledge. Maybe it was the exhaustion and the fading overload of adrenaline, but Ethan missed the transition entirely, from outside to in. The light of the lantern now shone on rock walls all around him, even overhead, and the air had spiked 10 degrees. Their footfalls made an echo. They moved through a cavern. Up ahead, a din of voices. Music. Ethan followed the men to the end of the passage. The sudden onslaught of light burned his eyes. His guides walked on, but Ethan stopped at the wide, open door. Couldn't quite grasp what he was seeing. Couldn't fit it into a previous point of reference. The room was several thousand square feet, the footprint of a comfortable house. The ceiling dipped low at the corners, vaulted past 20 feet in the center. The rock walls glowed the color of adobe in the abundance of firelight. There were candles everywhere, torches, kerosene lamps dangling from wires in the ceiling. It was warm, the heat radiating from a large fireplace in a distant corner, a recess in the room that apparently vented smoke outside. There were people everywhere, congregating in small groups, dancing, sitting in chairs around the fire. Nearby, a trio of musicians played on a makeshift stage, trumpet, stand-up bass, an upright piano that Ethan figured must have been disassembled and hauled up here in pieces. It was Hector Gaither on the bench, leading the band in some moody jazz thing that would have sounded right at home in a club in New York City. Everyone was dressed to the nines in clothes that couldn't have possibly made the trip Ethan had just endured. People were smoking, talking over the music, smiling, laughing, the smell of booze like perfume in the air. And then Kate was standing in front of him. She had dyed her hair to that Java brown, and she wore a black sleeveless number. Smiling and the glassiness of liquor glistening in her eyes like tears, she said, "Of all the gin joints and all the towns and all the world." She ran her hand down the left sleeve of his hoodie. "Looks like you had a rough hike in. Let's get you into something dry." She led him through the crowd to the far side of the room. They swung around into an alcove where the clothes the people had worn were hung dripping from wooden racks. 42 long, right? She asked. Yeah. She showed him to a black suit hanging from the end of a rack filled with dry, pristine formal wear. Looks like your old threads, huh? Shoes and socks right over there. Get dressed and come on out. Kate, we'll talk in there. She left him. He stripped out of his hoodie, his undershirt, his damp jeans. There was a bench against the wall, and he sat down and pulled off his boots and inspected the incision. A few of the stitches had popped, but he'd brought along extra gauze and tape. He wrapped his leg tightly enough to stop the bleeding and used his damp undershirt to clean the line of dried blood that trailed all the way down to his foot. Walking back into the party, Ethan couldn't deny that he felt like a brand new man. There'd been a mirror in the changing room, and he'd combed his wet hair over to the side in the style he'd worn back in his G-Man days. Someone had constructed a bar along one side of the cavern. Ethan threaded his way toward it, through the crowd, and installed himself in an open stool. The bartender wandered over. White Oxford, black tie, black vest. Refreshingly old school. He threw a cocktail napkin down on the dark, scuffed wood of the bar. Ethan recognized him from town. They'd never spoken, but he worked the cash register several days a week at the grocery store. "What'll it be?" the man asked, no indication that he knew or cared who Ethan was. "What do you have?" Ethan asked, glancing at the bottles lined up on the wall in front of a mirror. He saw bourbon, scotch, vodka. Brand names he recognized, but they were all nearly empty. Unlabeled bottles of clear liquor seemed to be in ample supply. The mirror had been framed with dozens of Polaroid photos. One toward the center caught his eye. It was a close-up of Kate and Alyssa, both women dressed like flappers, newsboy caps, bobbed hair, gaudy makeup, and pearls. Their cheeks were pressed together. They looked drunk in the moment and irredeemably happy. The barkeep said, "Sir?" "Johnny Walker Blue. Neat." "Those bottles are actually more for atmosphere and extra special occasions." "All right. What do you recommend?" "I make a mean martini." "By all means." He watched the barkeep pour from various unmarked bottles into a big martini glass, which he set on Ethan's napkin and garnished with a wedge of green apple. The man said, "Cheers. First one's on me." As Ethan raised the glass to his lips, he heard Kate's voice. "Now try and keep an open mind." She claimed the bar stool beside him as he sipped. He said, "Wow. Well, at least they got the glassware right. Until now, I've never actually wanted to untaste something." It was odorless, but on the tongue, the overwhelming note was burn, followed by a strong citrus pucker and a finish that was mercifully short, like the flavor had just fallen off a cliff. He carefully returned the martini glass to the napkin.
"You aren't going to tell me this bathtub gin grows on you."
Kate laughed. "You look good, Agent Burke. I have to say the elegance of the black suit and tie suits you 1,000 times better than that woodsy sheriff getup." In the reflection of the mirror, people were dancing to a slow jazz tune. He spotted Imming and his goons in tuxedos, passing a mason jar and watching the band. Ethan reached for the stem of the martini glass, thought better of it. "Nice digs," he said. "How'd you get all this up here?" "We've been bringing things for years. Glad you could make it."
"Well, I barely did, and I still don't understand what it is I made it to. Is this a costume party?"
"Kind of."
"So what's everyone pretending to be?"
"See, that's the thing. Nobody here is pretending, Ethan. This is a place to come and be who you really are." She turned in her bar stool, surveyed the crowd. "We talk about our past here, our lives before, who we were, where we lived. We remember the people we loved, who we've been separated from. We talk about wayward pines. We talk about whatever we want, and we have no fear of anything inside this room. It isn't allowed."
"Do you talk about leaving?"
"No."
"So you've never been to the fence?"
She sipped the foul concoction, posing as a martini. "Once."
"But you didn't go to the other side?"
"No, I just wanted to see it. Since we started coming to this cave, we've had 3 people cross to the other side."
"How?"
She hesitated. "There's a secret tunnel."
"And let me guess."
"What?"
"None of them ever returned."
"That's right." She stepped down off her stool. "Dance with me." Ethan took her hand. They walked across the uneven rock into the throng of slow dancers. He cupped his hand to her back, but kept a respectful distance. "Harold won't mind," Kate said. "He's not the jealous type." Ethan pulled her close, their bodies almost touching.
"How about this?"
"When I said he's not the jealous type, that wasn't a dare."
But she didn't pull back. They danced. He hated how good it felt to touch her again. "What do all these people think of me being here? They act like they don't even realize the sheriff is in the house."
"Oh, they realize. We had discussions about it. I convinced them you could be trusted, that we needed you. I stuck my neck out."
"You do need me. That's true.
Question is, do we have you?"
"If I say no, will I wind up naked and stabbed to death in the middle of the road?"
He felt Kate's fingernails dig into his shoulder. There was fire in her eyes. "Not me. Not any of my people laid a finger on Alyssa. We aren't revolutionaries, Ethan. We don't come to this cave to stockpile weapons and plan a coup. We meet here to be in a place where we aren't watched, to feel like human beings instead of prisoners." He guided her away from the music.
"I've been wondering something," he said.
"What?"
2 things, really. First, how did you figure out that you had a microchip in your leg? Second, how did you know that if you removed the microchip, the cameras wouldn't see you? I don't know how you could possibly have just guessed that."
She looked away from him. Ethan pulled her out of the main cavern and into the colder passageway. It had been there always, he saw it now, an embedded suspicion. But up until this moment, until he'd actually voiced the question, the simplicity of the truth had eluded him. He said, "Kate, look at me. Tell me the truth about Alyssa.
I did.
God, he'd forgotten how well he knew this woman, how easily he could see straight through her. He thought of the photograph of Kate and Alyssa behind the bar as he caught something else in her eyes that she could no longer hide. Pain. Loss. She wasn't only their spy, was she? Kate's eyes filling with tears. She was yours, too. They spilled down her cheeks, and she let them go. She said,
Alyssa reached out to me.
When?
Years ago.
Years? So you know everything. You've known all this time.
No.
She never told us what was beyond the fence. She said it was for our own safety. In fact, she made it clear that leaving would be death, that all of us, her included, were stuck here. I believed her. Most of us did. I never knew where Alyssa came from, where she lived when she wasn't in town, how she knew all these things that we didn't. But she hated how we're treated, these conditions. She said there were others like her who felt the same way, and she gave her life to help.
She was your friend?
One of my best.
So the bell pepper, the secret notes, Alyssa's investigation, all for show. They made her investigate us. Maybe they were on to her, suspected what she was doing.
Do you know who they are? Did she ever tell you?
No.
In the cavern, the band was playing a new song, something fast. People were jitterbugging. Ethan said, Was Alyssa even here 3 nights ago?
No, there was no meeting. Too risky. But she'd been here plenty of times before. The night she died, I met her in the crypt. We talked about what she was going to do. They were expecting a full report from her. They wanted her to name names, to turn us all in, so examples could be made.
What did you and Alyssa decide she should do?
Make up an excuse for why she didn't get to see our group. It was the only option.
What time did you and Alyssa part ways? This is very important.
As I was walking home, I remember hearing the clock strike 2.
And where was this exactly?
Corner of 8th and Main?
Where'd she go after you left her?
I have no idea.
No, I mean which direction?
Oh, I think she started walking south down the sidewalk.
Toward the hospital?
Right.
And there's no possible way one of your people killed her. Maybe someone who knew she knew the truth? Who was willing to do anything to get it?
Impossible.
You're absolutely certain. Those boys who brought me here tonight had more than a few rough ideas. And machetes.
Well, they don't trust you. But they loved Alyssa. Everyone did. Besides, it's no secret among my people that there's a tunnel under the fence. Alyssa wasn't stopping anyone from leaving.
Then what does stop them?
The people who left never came back.
He got that Johnny Walker Blue after all. Kate went behind the bar, requisitioned the bottle and 2 rocks glasses, and carried them to a small table out of the main current of the noise and the motion. They drank and watched the crowd and listened to the music, Ethan studying the faces, becoming increasingly floored because no one in this room was someone he would have expected to be in this room. In Wayward Pines, this crowd walked the line like perfect little townies, followed the rules, caused nary a ripple. He would have pegged most everyone here as full-on converts to everything that life in Wayward Pines entailed, and yet here they were, freed of their microchips, at least for a few hours, drunk and happy and dancing in a cavern. After the song, the band quit playing. The dynamic in the room changed almost instantly. People found seats at tables or sat on the floor against the rock wall. Ethan leaned over to Kate, whispered,
What's happening?
You'll see.
Kate's husband walked over to their table. Ethan stood.
Harold Ballinger, the man said. I don't believe we've actually met.
Ethan Burke. They shook hands.
You worked with my wife many years ago.
That's right.
I'd love to hear about it sometime.
As they sat down, Ethan wondered if Kate had even told her husband about their time together. He wasn't getting that vibe. A man was arranging torches in a half-circle around the front of the stage. He stepped down, and a woman in a strapless dress took his place in the firelight. Only her blonde dreads gave her away. It was the barista from the coffee shop. She was smiling, holding a martini glass in one hand, a hand-rolled cigarette in the other. There was no microphone. She said, "It's getting late. I think we only have time for one share tonight." A man stood, asked, "Okay if I go?"
"Sure. Come on up."
He made his way to the stage in a dark suit that didn't quite fit him, a little short in the cuffs, a little tight across the chest, and as he stepped into the spotlight and the candles lit his face, Ethan realized it was Brad Fisher. He and Teresa had eaten dinner at the man's house just 2 nights ago. Ethan scanned the crowd, but he didn't see Mrs. Fisher. Brad cleared his throat, nervousness in his smile.
"My third time here," he said. "Some of you know me, most of you don't, yet. I'm Brad Fisher."
The room responded like an AA meeting. "Hello, Brad," he said.
"First of all, where's Harold?"
"Back here," Harold yelled.
Brad turned slightly so he faced Ethan's table.
"Harold came into my office 2 months ago, and without going into too much detail, made it possible for me to come here. I don't know how to thank you, Harold. I'm not sure I'll ever be able to."
Harold waved him off and yelled, "Pay it forward."
Laughter shuddered through the room. Brad went on. "I was born in Sacramento, California, in 1966. It's funny, the week before I woke up in Wayward Pines, I thought I had finally arrived at the prime of my life. I actually remember thinking those exact words. I had this great new job in Silicon Valley, and I had just married my best friend. Her name was Nancy. We met at Golden Gate Park. Don't know if any of you know San Fran. There's this Japanese tea garden. We met on the Moon Bridge. It was..." His face softened at the memory. "So cheesy. One of those high-arching bridges. I mean, it was something out of a movie. We always laughed about it. For our honeymoon, we opted for a road trip instead of a tropical getaway. We'd only known each other 6 months, and there was something that sounded right about just being on the road together, driving across the West. We kept it loose. We didn't make plans. It was the best time of my life." Even from the back of the room, Ethan could see that Brad was steeling himself to go on. "A week or so into our trip, Nancy and I hit Idaho. Stayed in Boise for the first night, and I still remember that morning over breakfast when Nancy picked Wayward Pines off the map. It was in the mountains. She liked the sound of it. We checked into the Wayward Pines Hotel, had dinner at the Aspen House. We ate on the patio, all those white lights strung from the aspen trees twinkling above us. It was one of those nights. You know what I mean, right? You talk about the future over a bottle of wine, and everything seems possible and within reach. We went back to our room and made love and fell asleep, and when we woke up, we were here and nothing has ever been the same. Nance lasted 2 months, and then she took her own life. Now I live with a stranger with whom I never shared a single authentic moment. It's been a lonely couple of years since I woke up in Pines, and that's why meeting Harold, and now all of you, people who I can share real moments with, is the best thing that's happened to me in a very long time." He sipped his martini, winced. "It grows on you, right?" Someone shouted, "Never!" More laughter. Brad said, "I know we all have to start the cold walk home pretty soon, but I hope I can get up here and talk more about my wife. My real wife." Now he raised his glass. "Her name was Nancy, and I love her. I miss her." Here came the emotion. "And I think about her every single day." Everyone in the room stood, glasses raised, winking in the firelight. The room said, "To Nancy." They drank, and then Brad stepped down off the stage. Ethan watched him walk out into the passageway where the man slid down onto the floor and wept. Ethan looked at Kate, wondered what her group thought of the striking incongruence of time. Brad Fisher had said he was born in 1966, but the man couldn't have been older than 29 or 30, which meant he had come to Wayward Pines, Idaho, in the mid-1990s, with Bill Clinton president and 9/11 still 5 or 6 years away. No doubt others in this room had come to town before him and after him. What did they make of it? Did they compare and contrast their own views of the world before, searching for meaning in their current existence? Did those who had arrived around the same time seek one another out for the comfort of a shared knowledge of history? "Imagine it," she said. "First time in 2 years he's been able to openly speak about his real wife." People were forming a line to the dressing room. "What about his Wayward Pines wife, Megan?" Ethan asked. "He couldn't bring her?"
"She's a teacher."
"So?"
"They're true believers. Someone scored him a dose of something that he probably slipped into his wife's water at dinner, knocked her out cold for the entire night so he could slip out."
"So she doesn't know he's coming to these?"
"No way.
And she can't ever find out." Everyone had left. Ethan changed out of his black suit and back into the damp jeans and hoodie. In the main cavern, Kate was blowing out candles, and Harold was collecting empty martini glasses and lining them up on the bar. With the last candle, Kate lit a kerosene lamp for the journey home. They followed Harold down the passageway. Outside, the sky had cleared. Stars blazed down out of the dark, and the moon was bright. Harold took Kate's lamp and slung it over his shoulder, and they all moved down the ledge to where the path swung out across the face of the cliff. All of the homeward-bound foot traffic had polished the wooden planks and the cables clean of snow. Ethan could see Wayward Pines now, snow-mantled and silent in the valley below. White roofs, twinkling lights. He thought of all the people down there, those dreaming of their lives before, those still awake in the wee hours in their private prisons, wondering what their lives had become, not knowing if they were alive or dead. The men and women trudged home from the cavern in wet clothes back to a world they knew was wrong. His wife, his son. Kate said,
"Ethan, I have to know."
"Know what?"
"How bad was it? What they did to Alyssa. Did she suffer?"
Ethan reached for the cable and took that first stomach-churning step onto the plank. He told himself not to look down, but he couldn't resist the urge. The forest was 300 feet below the soles of his boots, the pine trees crowned with snow. "She died quickly," he lied.
"Please don't do that," Kate said. "I want the truth. How much did they hurt her?"
It had been heady in the cavern, but now the question came in a rush of mounting heat. Had Alyssa been tortured by Pilcher's people to name the members of Kate's group, or killed by Kate's people to stop her from naming them?
"Ethan?"
Where had it happened?
"Ethan!"
Who had cut her? Pilcher didn't murder his daughter. Was Kate playing him?
"What did they do to my friend?" she asked. "I have to know."
He glanced back at the woman he had once loved. She and her husband were standing on the ledge of the cliff. He'd assumed he would come out of this night with a better understanding of what had happened to Alyssa, but he only felt more uncertain, plagued with more questions. Pilcher's words beginning to echo through his head. "You have no idea what she's capable of." "They tore her up, Kate," Ethan said. "They tore her up bad." Chapter 19. The exhaustion hit him at the intersection of 8th and Main. He was alone now, had split off from Kate and Harold several blocks back. The sky wasn't that deep blue-black anymore. Stars fading, dawn coming. He felt like he'd been awake forever, couldn't remember the last good night of sleep he'd logged.
His legs ached. His stitches had ripped again. He was cold and thirsty, and just 4 blocks away his house beckoned. He would strip out of his wet, freezing clothes, climb under as many blankets as he could amass, and just recharge. Get his head right for... The noise of an approaching car turned his head. He stared south toward the hospital. Headlights raced in his direction. The sight of them stopped him in the crosswalk under the traffic light. It was something you hardly ever saw in Wayward Pines, a car actually driving through town. There were plenty of vehicles parked along the streets, and most of them ran. There was even a filling station at the edge of town with a mechanic next door, but people rarely drove. It was mainly set decoration. For a moment he imagined the impossible, that it was a minivan heading toward him. Dad behind the wheel, Mom asleep beside him in the front seat, kids in dreamland in the back. Maybe they'd been driving all night from Spokane or Missoula. Maybe they were coming here on vacation. Maybe just passing through. It wasn't real, he knew that. But for a half second, standing in the pre-dawn stillness in the middle of town, it felt possible. The approaching car was hauling ass down the middle of Main, tires straddling the white line, RPMs in the red. It must have been doing 60 or 70, the racket of the engine reverberating between the dark buildings, high beams flooding his eyes. It had just occurred to Ethan that he might want to get out of the road when he heard the RPMs fall off. The Jeep Wrangler that had taken him up into the mountain so many times before slid to a stop in the crosswalk in front of him. No doors, no soft top. Ethan heard the emergency brake engage. Marcus stared at Ethan from behind the wheel, a grogginess in his eyes hinting that he hadn't been awake for long. Over the idling engine he said, "You gotta come with me, Mr. Burke." Ethan put his hand on the padded roll bar. "Pilcher sent you to get me at 5 in the morning? "He called your house. No one answered." "Because I've been out all night doing what he asked me to do." "Well, he wants to see you right away." "Marcus, I'm tired, cold, and wet. You tell him I'm going home, taking a shower and getting some sleep. Then, I'm sorry, but that's not going to work, Mr. Burke."
"Excuse me?"
"Mr. Pilcher said now."
"Mr. Pilcher can fuck right off."
The traffic signal above them threw alternating colors on the Jeep, on Marcus's face, on the gun he was suddenly pointing at Ethan's chest. It looked like a Glock, but Ethan couldn't be sure in the twilight. He studied Marcus. Anger. Fear. Nerves. The shake in the gun was barely perceptible.
"Get in the Jeep, Mr. Burke. I'm sorry to have to do this, but I got my orders, and they're to take you to Mr. Pilcher's office. You were a soldier, right? You understand that sometimes you gotta do what you're told, and whether or not you like it doesn't matter."
"I was a soldier," Ethan said. "I flew Black Hawk. Carried men into battles I knew they wouldn't return from. Unleashed hell on insurgents. And yeah, I took orders." Ethan climbed into the passenger seat and stared down the barrel of the pistol into Marcus's stormy eyes. "But I took them from men who had my total trust and respect."
"Mr. Pilcher's got mine."
"Good for him.
Your seatbelt, Mr. Burke?"
Ethan buckled his seatbelt. Guess he wasn't going to get that recharge after all. Marcus holstered his weapon, released the emergency brake, and shifted into first. Popping the clutch, he whipped the Jeep around on the snowy pavement and floored it up Main Street, the back of the Wrangler fishtailing as the tires sought out traction. They shot past the hospital going 55, still accelerating as they approached the darkness beyond the edge of town. When the road entered the forest, Marcus downshifted into third. Ethan had been uncomfortable walking home, but at least he'd been moving enough to keep the blood circulating. This was miserable, the wind screaming into the Jeep, chilling him down to his core. Marcus downshifted again and veered off the road into the trees. Maybe he wasn't thinking clearly, but the last thing Ethan intended to do was show up for a meeting with Pilcher. As they neared the boulders, Marcus reached into his parka and pulled out something that resembled a garage door opener. In the distance, a triangle of light began to spread across the snow.
Marcus brought the jeep to a stop at the foot of the rock outcropping. The wide door in the cliff was still opening, sliding up and back into the rock. Ethan's fingers were so numb he could hardly feel them gripping the knife. He flicked open the blade and leaned over in one movement. The curved point digging into the side of Marcus's windpipe before he'd even thought to react. His right hand slipped off the steering wheel, reached for the gun. Ethan said, "I will open you up." Marcus put his hand back on the wheel. "Squeeze that wheel like your life depended on it, because it does." The mountain was wide open now, light shining out from the tunnel into the snow and the surrounding trees. Ethan spoke into Marcus's ear. "Very slowly, take your right hand off the wheel, reach down, and shift into first. Keep your hand on the stick and drive into the tunnel. Once we're inside, turn off the engine. You understand what I'm telling you?" Marcus nodded. "I don't want to hurt you, Marcus, but I will. I've killed before, in war, even in this town. I'll do it again. Don't think I won't, just because I know you. That will not be a factor." Marcus's hand shook as he palmed the gear shift and worked it into first. He gave a little gas and they rolled slowly into the tunnel. Marcus brought the jeep to a full stop just inside, like he'd been told. As the door lowered behind them, Ethan pulled the gun out of Marcus's holster. A Heckler & Koch USP, chambered for .40 caliber. He wondered if there were cameras watching. Marcus said, "You're finished. You know that, right?" Ethan twirled the H&K, so he gripped it by the barrel. Marcus saw it coming, started to cover up, but Ethan caught him flush on the side of the head with the butt of the composite stock. Marcus sagged back and would have toppled out of the jeep, but his seatbelt caught him. Ethan snatched his identification card off his coat, unbuckled him, and let gravity pull him the rest of the way down onto the pavement. Then he unbuckled himself and climbed over into the driver's seat, jammed his foot into the clutch, cranked the engine. Soon, he was hurtling up the road into the mountain. The giant hanging globe lights hummed above him in the massive cavern, but otherwise the superstructure was quiet. Ethan checked the load on the H&K. Had to laugh. Of course, there was nothing in the chamber. He ejected the magazine, empty as well. Tossing the pistol into the back seat, he stepped down out of the jeep. At the sliding glass doors, he dug Marcus's ID card out of his pocket and swiped it through the reader. The level one corridor was empty at this hour of the morning. Ethan took the stairwell up to the next floor. The long stretch of checkered tile gleamed under the fluorescent lights and the corridor echoed with his footfalls. It felt strangely illicit, walking these hallways by himself, unsupervised, unchaperoned. Down toward the end, he stopped at the door leading into surveillance and peered through the glass. Someone sat at the console scrolling through the camera feeds, mostly shots of people tossing and turning and fucking in their beds, bodies indistinct through the glow of night vision. He swiped Marcus's keycard. The door unlocked. He stepped inside. The man at the console swiveled around in his chair. Ted, head of surveillance. The last guy Ethan was hoping to find at the consoles.
"Sheriff?"
There was a note of alarm in Ted's voice.
"I didn't know you were dropping by."
"Yeah, I didn't put this one on the schedule." Ethan moved toward the wall of screens as the door closed after him. He said, "Show me your hands."
"I don't understand."
"You don't understand what 'show me your hands' means, Ted?" Ethan took out the knife. Ted slowly raised his hands. The room smelled of stale coffee. Ethan said, "Anyone next door?"
"Two guys,"
Ted said. "Any reason to expect your techs might make a surprise visit?"
"I don't think so. They typically keep their noses to the grindstone."
"Let's hope so, for everyone's health and safety." Ethan eased down into the chair next to Ted's. The man's hands shook, and this gave Ethan a small push of relief. If he was afraid, he could be controlled.
The lenses in the man's glasses were as big as windows, and the large dilated pupils behind them looked bleary and fried. "You've been up all night, Ted?"
"Yes."
"How long until you're off shift? And please understand that lying to me about this is the last thing you want to do." Ted rotated his wrist so he could see the face of his watch.
34 minutes.
"Are you scared, Ted?" The man nodded slowly. "That's good. You should be scared."
"Why are you doing this, Sheriff?"
"To get some answers. You can put your hands on your lap, Ted." The man wiped his brow on his shirt sleeves and placed his palms flat against his cotton pants. "I just want to make something very clear," Ethan said.
"Yes?"
"I don't know if you have an alarm in here, some sneaky way of notifying people you're in trouble. But if that happens, if you make that mistake, I will kill you."
"I understand."
"I don't care if 30 armed guards show up outside that door. If it opens, I'm assuming you called someone, and the last thing I do before I'm taken down is cut your throat."
"Okay."
"I don't want that to happen, Ted."
"Me either."
"That's up to you. Now let's go to work. Wipe the screens of the current video feeds." Ted turned slowly in his chair and faced the console. He tapped at a panel and the 25 screens went dark. "First things first," Ethan said. "I assume there's a live camera feed on the level 2 corridor right outside that door?"
"There can be."
"Bring it up and put it on that monitor in the top right corner." A long shot of the level 2 corridor appeared. Empty. "Now I want to see where Pilcher is."
"He isn't chipped."
"Of course he isn't. Are there cameras in his residence or his office?"
"No."
"Does that seem right to you?"
"I don't know."
"How about his number 2? Where's Pam, or is she off the radar too?"
"Nope. We should be able to locate her."
A screen in the upper left-hand corner flashed to life. Ted said,
"There she is."
It was a shot of the gym from a camera in the corner, a room filled with exercise bikes, treadmills, free weights. The place was empty except for one woman in the center of the frame, doing effortless-looking pull-ups on a bar. "You just keyed off her microchip?"
"That's right. What's this all about, Ethan?"
Ethan glanced over at the feed of the level 2 corridor, still empty. Said, "You got a camera down at the entrance to the tunnel?" Ted's fingers went to work. The tunnel appeared. Marcus was sitting up on the concrete, his head hung between his legs.
"Who's that?" Ted asked.
"That was my escort."
"What happened to him?"
"He pulled a gun on me." Marcus was trying to stand. He made it onto his feet, but his legs suddenly buckled, and he sat back down on the road. "Let me ask you something, Ted."
"What's that?"
"What'd you do before Pilcher brought you on board?"
"When I met him, my wife had been dead a year. I was homeless, drinking myself to death. He used to volunteer at the shelter where I sometimes stayed."
"So you met him while he was serving you soup?"
"That's right. He helped me clean up. I'd be dead if he hadn't come into my life. No doubt in my mind."
"So you believe he's above suspicion? Can do no wrong?"
"Did you hear me say that, Sheriff?"
Up on the screens, Marcus was standing now, attempting to take a wobbling step up the tunnel. "Ted, last time I was here, you showed me how you could track a microchip, see where someone had been."
"Yep."
"I assume that's not possible with Pilcher."
"Correct."
"How about Pam?" Ted turned in his chair.
"Why?"
Marcus was stumbling up the tunnel now. "Just do it."
"What date range?"
"I want to see where she went 3 nights ago. All the screens turned dark. They merged into a single aerial overview of Wayward Pines, and a red blip appeared over top of the mountain south of town. "What's that location?" Ethan asked.
"The superstructure?"
"Can you push in?"
"Yeah, but it's just going to zoom in on trees on the mountainside. We have a highly developed aerial grid over town, but not over this complex."
There were numbers, what looked like military time, in the bottom right-hand corner of the screens. "This is her location at 2100 hours?" Ethan asked.
"Yeah, 9 p.m.
"All right. Take us forward slowly." Time sprinted by, seconds, minutes, hours, but the blip didn't move out of the mountain. Ted paused everything, said,
"We're now at 1 in the morning.
Pam still hasn't left the mountain. Run it forward." Just before 1:30 a.m., the blip moved out of the mountain, through the forest, and onto the road into Wayward Pines. Ted pushed in. The Pam blip grew larger, now moving quickly down the road toward town. Ethan said, "Do that thing where it shows all the areas that are covered under visual surveillance." The Dayglow overlay appeared. "Since Pam is chipped, her movement will trigger camera footage, correct?" Ethan asked.
"Yes."
Pam took a back street that ran parallel to Main. "Now what's our time?"
1:49 a.m.
"Can we actually see her on camera?"
"Weird."
"What?"
"I'm not getting a view cam feed option."
Ted pushed in closer. An entire city block filled the 25 screens.
"Oh, that's why. See? She's standing in a blind spot."
Up close, there was a scattershot of dark spaces in the day glow, and as the seconds whirled by, Pam seemed to always stay in the black.
"She's good," Ted said. "Knows all the camera placements and where to go to stay out of the footage."
Ethan said, "Run it out to 1:55 a.m. Ted zipped ahead several minutes. At 1:55 exactly, Pam's blip hovered on the south side of the Opera House at the corner of Main and 8th.
"You were there. The night of Alyssa's death, you were watching when she and Kate split up."
Ted said,
"Maybe if you told me what we're looking for, I could help you."
At 1:59, Pam started moving south.
"And then you followed Alyssa."
Pam passed into an area of Dayglow. Ted said,
"I have a view cam feed option. Let's see it."
The screens changed to a camera view of Main Street. It was a grainy, night vision shot, but Ethan could just make out the shadow of Pam walking quickly down the sidewalk. She passed out of view. The feed went black. The screens returned to the aerial map.
"What was she doing in town?" Ted asked.
At 1:59, Alyssa and Kate Ballinger part ways at the corner of Main and 8th. Neither woman is chipped, so there's no footage. I'm told that Alyssa headed south, presumably toward the superstructure. Pam follows Alyssa. Keep in mind that several hours later, near the pastures south of town, I'll discover Alyssa, naked in the middle of the road, tortured to death.
"The Wanderers killed Alyssa."
"Maybe, maybe not." "Check our 3 surveillance cams, Ted." Ted switched back. Marcus had vanished from the tunnel door cam. Pam had left the gym. The level 2 corridor stood empty.
"Go back to where we were," Ethan said. "Let's see where she goes."
Ted switched to the aerial view of Wayward Pines. Pam continued south out of town. Where the road curved back, her blip moved into the forest and went all the way to the fence. Ethan asked, "Can you add my microchip to these screens?"
"You mean for the same moment in time?"
"Exactly." Ethan's blip appeared.
"So you were there with Pam?" Ted said. "I don't understand."
"I was. 3 nights ago, at the fence, Peter McCall had just died."
"Oh, I remember that."
"Now run Pam's trajectory again, from 1:59 a.m. until she reaches me and the fence." Ted replayed Pam's movement.
"I'm not following," Ted said.
"Then run it again." He ran it 3 more times, and at the end of the third said,
"What the hell?"
Ted leaned forward in his seat. His demeanor had changed. Less fear, more intensity, more focus. Ethan said, "Am I wrong? Or are there 2.5 hours missing from Pam's surveillance on the night Alyssa was murdered?" Ted rewound the footage. He pushed in until the blip itself took up 4 screens, then played it over and over and over.
"The time jump is seamless," Ted said. "The only tell is the running clock."
He typed furiously across the keyboards. An error code flashed on the screens. Ted stared at it, his head cocked, like it didn't compute.
"What does that mean?" Ethan asked.
"There's a missing data field from 2:04 a.m. until 4:33 a.m.
"How is that possible?"
"Someone deleted it. Let me try one other thing."
Now the screen showed that Ted was typing a long, incomprehensible line of code. It only returned a different error message. Ted said,
"I just ran a systems restore back to 60 seconds before the time jump ahead, and the surveillance we're looking for has been deep-sixed."
"Which means what exactly?"
"It's been erased."
"Could Pilcher or Pam have done this?"
"Definitely not. I mean, not by themselves. The deletion itself would be practically impossible, but to patch Pam's surveillance history back together with a missing data field and make it look so flawless? No way. That took a high level of expertise."
"So who would have helped them? One of your surveillance techs?"
"Only if they were ordered to."
"You weren't asked to do this?"
"No, I swear to you."
"How many on your team are capable of something like this?"
2.
Ethan pointed his knife at the door at the end of the massive control panel.
"Are they in there now?"
Ted hesitated.
"Ted."
"One of them is."
Ethan started toward the door. Ted said,
"Wait."
He pointed at the bank of screens, which had reverted to the live surveillance cameras inside the superstructure. Pam and Pilcher were coming down the level 2 corridor, 2 guards in tow. Ethan glared at Ted.
"You alerted them?"
"Of course not. Sit down."
"Why?"
Ted attacked the touchscreens. The surveillance cam feeds disappeared.
"Get them back," Ethan said. "If this means what I think it means, we don't need that on screen when they walk in here."
Ted pulled an aerial map of Wayward Pines, zoomed down onto Kate Ballinger's house, and exploded the interactive blueprint. He pushed down into the camera over her bed. Kate and Harold filled the screens, dawn light coming through their windows as they dressed. Ethan took a seat.
"You're actually helping me?"
"Maybe."
Voices came into range just outside the door, then the sound of a lock clicking back.
"You'd better think of something quick, Sheriff,"
Ethan said.
"One last thing. If I needed to speak to someone in a pinch in the middle of the night, in the middle of town, the bench on the corner of Main and Ninth, blind spot, deaf spot."
The door opened. Pilcher entered first, Pam right on his heels. He said over his shoulder, presumably to the guards,
"Just hang back a moment. I'll let you know."
Pilcher strode into the middle of the room and stared down at Ethan with a bright, focused anger.
"Marcus is in the infirmary with a concussion and a cracked skull."
Ethan said, "Little shit pointed a gun at me. Lucky he's not in the morgue."
"You give him that authority?" "I told him to drive into town, find you, and bring you back to me by whatever means necessary."
"Well then, I guess he has you to thank for the cracked skull."
"What are you doing here?"
"What's it look like?"
Pilcher looked at Ted. Ted volunteered.
"He wanted to see some live footage of the Ballinger residence."
On the screens, Kate had moved into the kitchen. She was running water through a French press, washing out the old coffee grounds. Pilcher smiled.
"What's wrong, Ethan? Didn't get enough FaceTime last night? I'd like to see you in my residence right now."
Ethan stepped toward Pilcher. He had a good 6 inches on the man as he stared down at the tip of his nose.
Said, "I'd be happy to accompany you, David, but first I feel the need to share with you that if you ever pull any shit like that again, sending your lackey to fetch me with a gun—"
"Careful!"
Pilcher cut him off. The back end of that sentence could be expensive. He looked around the side of Ethan. You sure everything's okay here, Ted?
Yes, sir.
Pilcher looked